You are likely here because something in you called you to the comfort and companionship of human community. You are likely here because at some point in your life you have felt called to reach out, to care for more than your own self. Maybe you hear that call now loud and clear. Or maybe you have done so much caring for others that your stores are depleted. You need to replenish, renew, receive. In either case, this is the time to listen to your own call. Whatever it is you need to hear this day. This is the time to breathe deeply. Relax and listen to that still small voice within. In this prayerful stance, let us join the choir in singing a meditative invocation and then share in a full minute of quiet reflection.
Thank you. I'm going to share with you this morning the first time I heard someone call my name. Many of us have been working as environmentalists and social justice advocates for years. We write letters, we sing with the raging grannies, we carry banners, sometimes we get arrested, we yearn for a better world. As I was thinking about this, I wondered about that first dawning of understanding in each one of our lives that the world could be unjust, out of balance somehow, simply not fair. What happened? When? I would love to hear your stories. In fact, I've been honored over these last couple of years to hear many already. Here's mine. It was the late 60s, a time of turmoil. So much was changing so quickly, actually a lot like it is now, that it was hard to follow, much less know what you felt about it all. Women's lib, civil rights, the war in Vietnam, it all swirled around and onto the new and magic internet of the day, color TV. Then there was the very idea that one could take to the streets and protest unjust actions, unjust laws. It was very heady and exciting. One day, there was a big peace march planned for Parliament Hill. It was a nice day, so I went down to watch with a few friends. It was our first solo trip for a demonstration. We'd told our parents we were going shopping. We were all about 13. We were surprised at how many people were there. Deciding to get closer, we wedged our way through until we were at the front of the crowd. Now, I don't remember any of the speeches, any of the signs, what was said at all, actually. This is what I remember. There was a young man trying to give the police a flower. It was the practice of the day. They either handed a policeman a flower or they put it in guns or whatever seemed appropriate at the time. He was pushed away. He fell and hit his head on the curb. As head wounds sometimes do, his opened up and blood was everywhere. He sat up, rather dazed, put his hands to his head, and then looked at them, looked at his hands, held them out, and closed his eyes. That's what I remember. There was a moment of silence, a hush that I will never forget. That vast desert in our world between war and peace, love and hate, intention and result, opened up and was embodied in this young man and his face raised to the sky. We've all seen those images. There's many saints and images of Jesus or other divine doing just that with their hands up. How? Why? Now, no harm was intended that day. In fact, the policeman picked him up gently and somebody took out a handkerchief to wipe his face. I was awash in emotion, sadness, anger, deep confusion. In that moment, though I didn't know it then, I was forever changed. For in that instant, I saw that place of yearning for change, that flash of understanding that what can be peace, connection, and justice, and what is are often not the same. I knew suddenly in my 13-year-old soul that we are responsible for making that place visible in the world, to foster empathy and true knowledge, which then allows this change. It has informed my whole life, my work, my family. I worked as a journalist for 35 years, wrote an environmental column for 7 of those when that was akin to howling in the wilderness. I even wrote for the province newspaper, their one and only ever environmental columnist. The men in my family are philosophers and people of heart. One daughter is articling as a lawyer, and the other lives and works in Africa. Why am I telling this story? Sometimes this yearning of a social activist is too big. There seems to be too much to change, too big a place to fill. One cannot hold on to only doing the one big thing. That's too daunting, making it too easy, often, to do nothing. That young man simply showing up at that march some 40 years ago causes ripples that live on today. You can't know what is going to make a difference. He simply brought his whole self to that march. His act of love with the flower was simple and probably not deeply thought out. He simply showed up, and it was more than enough. When I fall into the despair of too much chaos, not enough joy, I try to remember that flash I felt at 13. I try to unclench my hands to be open to what flows through me and not be attached to the outcome, to trust in this way of compassionate action. That yearning is, when I remember, colored by the call for serenity, the wisdom to be at peace with what I can do, to just show up. It helps to hold at bay the despair that can come with deep caring. I've named that feeling because it helps me to remember that day, and it still brings me peace. I call it yearning with soft hands. May it always be so.
Like many of you, when I was in my teens and 20s, I was very earnest and enthusiastic about working to make the world a better place. Through the church of my childhood in Los Angeles, I served the homeless, I raised money for world hunger through benefit walks and little cardboard collection boxes. I visited an orphanage in Tijuana with my youth group, bringing supplies to and spending time with the children there. Through Amnesty International, I wrote stacks of letters for human rights around the world. At university, I learned about the dynamics of racism, sexism, homophobia, classism, and the interconnection of all oppressions. I did a stint as an escort at Planned Parenthood and joined busloads of students to attend marches on Washington, D.C. for various causes. It all felt so invigorating and satisfying. I was riveted by the new insights I learned about systematized and institutionalized oppression. I even liked the self-reflective workshops that helped me see how I, as an upper middle class white Western woman of privilege, unknowingly supported oppressive systems. It was sometimes difficult work, but it was always rich work. I thrived on feeling that I was doing good in the world. In graduate school, my justice yearning and striving led me to undertake a study of the Christian right and the possibility of dialogue between people with opposing views. It was disheartening work. At the time, I was journaling with images as well as words. I dug up some of the images to illustrate for you the feelings with which I was wrestling. First, I laid out the problem. Good liberal that I am, I wrote, I'm doing my thesis on the possibility for dialogue between the religious right and the religious left. You see, I color-coded them. The fundamentalists are red. The progressives, called the liberals in the States, are green. And the dialogue is blue. Then I wrote in my journal about a church history research project I did for which I visited a fundamentalist Baptist church in person. There's the red church. There's me in green wearing a blue cape of dialogue. It was a painful experience. I felt dishonest not revealing my whole self, but at the same time, I felt afraid to reveal my true self. Academic, liberal, Unitarian Universalist, feminist, lesbian. Furthermore, as I sat through the service, I felt beat up by the preacher's rhetoric. He bashed the scientists and psychologists and said the liberals were in league with Hitler and the Nazis. It was all so twisted and hateful. I was glad that they couldn't see by looking at me that I was gay. I left feeling scared, defeated, and sick to my stomach. This feeling of hopelessness about the possible benefits of dialogue was reinforced by the fact that over the course of that same year, the conversations I had been having with a conservative Christian at my seminary seemed to have had zero impact. In many ways, he was a nice guy, certainly not as crazy as the pastor at the fundamentalist church. But in the end, he maintained the belief that my way of life was sinful, and he would most certainly vote to deny me and my family equal rights. Here is the drawing of me walking away from the red church, back over the blue bridge of dialogue, shedding the blue dialogue cape, and returning to my people at Education University and the Unitarian Universalist Congregation. There is now a closed gate at the bridge entrance with a sign that reads, "Bridge closed due to exhaustion and a sick stomach." Dialogue with the right wing may not be your issue, but have you ever felt in your social or eco-activist work that exhausted, defeated, helpless feeling? I have since felt cousins of that emotion with regard to different issues. I have felt overwhelmed and discouraged by how the cards seem stacked against us in our effort to forestall climate change. I felt dismayed by how impossible it seems to live a life that does not in some way harm our planet. It is difficult, not to mention expensive, to ensure that the clothes you purchase are not made in a sweatshop, to only eat food that is organic and local, to avoid using cars. I feel frustrated that I can't do it perfectly and guilty for all of my transgressions. I've often felt confused to the point of inaction about big political issues. Things are so complicated, it seldom is clear to me what the right thing to do is. Or even if I think I do know what is right, it is seldom clear to me how to effectively advocate for the change I seek. I wonder, for example, how does one effectively advocate for peace and human rights in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict? And as much as progressives seem to be against all pipeline projects, some people I respect say it's not that simple, which muddies the water for me as I try to sort it all through. In my guilt, in my confusion, in my despair, I feel an impulse to turn inward, to hold myself up in my own sheltered world and withdraw. As Unitarian Universalists, we yearn for a world in which all people care for one another and the planet we share. We yearn for a world free of violence, hatred, and the destruction of natural resources. As people living in reality as it is in 2015, our yearnings have often been trampled, blocked, thwarted. I wonder how each of you have responded to the barriers you've encountered on your road to fulfill your yearnings for social and ecological justice. Have you, after years and years of hard work, felt slowly ground down into exhaustion? Has the enormity of the problems made you feel small, helpless, and hopeless? Has the news ever been so upsetting that you have become numb to save your own soul, turned away from the larger world, occupying yourself with the mundane details of daily routines? Maybe the numbness, the desire to turn away from the pain, has taken the form of depression or the use of escapist behaviors and substances. Have the problems of the world ever felt so overwhelming and confusing that you felt trapped in inaction by the fact that the right path was so unclear? Has lack of action ever made you feel guilty? If you have experienced any of these reactions, you are not alone. Yearning for a better world in this day and age can be dispiriting work. Where then might we find a re-spiriting, a reinvigoration of the zeal we once had to help heal the world? It is my assertion that the very yearning that brought us to despair is the same yearning that can rekindle the fire of our passion and the light of hope. One of my favorite quotations to ponder when a loved one has died is this: when you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see in truth you are weeping for that which has been your delight. The sorrow is not a bad thing. It is a real thing. It is an expression of love, and love is a good thing. So it is with our world. Our grief about the world is painful, yes, but it belies a powerful love. Environmental activist Joanna Macy has developed practices that unleash the power of that love. In various formats, she invites activists to share with one another the difficult feelings that emerge for them as they do their work: helplessness, hopelessness, exhaustion, discouragement, guilt, numbness. She calls it despair work. In sharing these feelings, the power of the yearning is unblocked and can reemerge as creative energy for healing and action. Macy writes, "Just as grief work is a process by which bereaved persons unblock their numbed energies by acknowledging and grieving the loss of a loved one, so do we all need to unblock our feelings about our threatened planet and the possible demise of our species. Until we do, our power of creative response will be crippled." Macy continues, "The thousands of people with whom I've worked in church basements, community centers, and classrooms have revealed to me in ways I had not foreseen the power, size, and beauty of the human heart. They have demonstrated that pain for our world touches each of us and that this pain is rooted in caring. They have demonstrated that our apparent public apathy is but a fear of experiencing and expressing this pain, and that once it is acknowledged and shared, it opens the way to our power. Pain is morbid only if denied," Macy states. "Unblocking our pain for the world reconnects us with the larger web of life." Unitarian Universalist theologian Reverend Dr. Rebecca Parker illustrates this dynamic with a story of a man who was stuck in deep grief from witnessing the brutality of war. Parker writes, "At the end of World War II, Lyle Grunkenmeyer came home to Iowa. His mother and sister waited for his return. The day he came home, the only veteran to return alive to that town, everyone came out to meet him. As the train pulled into the station, the band played and the mayor was there to shake his hand. But as his sister later told me, the man who climbed off the train was not the cheerful boy who had left for the war. He was a ghost. He didn't seem to recognize anyone, not his mother, sister, or friends. In response to the crowd's rousing welcome, he stared mutely, blank. His family took him home to the farm where he sat in the old rocking chair in the parlor. He did not speak or move and would barely eat. He continued in this state for days that spilled into weeks that flowed into months. No one in this town knew about post-traumatic shock. They only knew that Lyle's soul was lost somewhere. Lyle's sister Maxine decided to stay by him. Whenever she could, she would come and sit with him, and she would talk. She'd tell him about the church potluck, who was there and what they ate. She'd tell him about the conversation she'd overheard at the store in town and how high the crops had grown. She told him how the wind that day had blown the clean laundry into the tomatoes. When she ran out of things to say, she would just sit with him, snapping beans, mending socks. And he sat there, silent, like a stone, rocking. One night, while Maxine was knitting quietly beside him, Lyle's eyes filled with tears. The tears spilled over and ran down his frozen face. Maxine went to her brother and put her arms around him. Held in his sister's embrace, he began to cry full force, great sobs of anguish bursting from deep inside him. Then he began to talk, and he would not stop. He talked of the cold, the fear, the noise, the death of his friends, the long marches, the smell. He talked all night until the dawn light began to creep across the fields. Maxine listened to everything Lyle had to say. Then she went into the kitchen and she cooked him breakfast. They ate together. And then Lyle went out and did the morning chores. This is what we do in religious community. We sit with one another through our pain, bear witness to one another's grief, so that the pain doesn't fester and kill our souls. Instead, we let the pain flow, and in so doing, we open to the flow of compassion, love, and healing. With the block lifted, we find that we can, once again, go out and do the morning chores. In graduate school, around the same time I was struggling with despair about the futility of dialogue with the right wing, I was moved by Matthew Fox's notion of creation spirituality. He envisioned the experience of life as a continuous flow between four poles: positive, negative, creative, and transformative. He uses Latin titles, via, for life. One website describes each of the poles thus: via positiva, befriending creation, celebration, awe, wonder, gratitude, being childlike, light, fullness. Via negativa, befriending darkness, silence, meditation, pain, suffering, hurt, solitude, darkness, emptiness. Via creativa, befriending creativity, expression, art, our own divinity, birth, resurrection, inspiration. Via transformativa, befriending new creation, compassion, justice, group celebration, transformation, brother and sisterhood, respect. This rubric made so much sense to me. Life is like that, a mix of joy, despair, creation, and transformation, all feeding into one another. Despair in via negativa can move you to express sorrow in art. Anger in via negativa can move you to work to fight injustice. The grace and the love of the earth in via positiva can similarly move you to create and to work toward healing the earth. Creative work can move you from despair to grace and then into action. Each pole connects you with the wider web of life in a different way. Spending time in each can help us renew our spirits and regain the energy to do transformative work in the world. This model lines up well with my notion of Unitarian Universalist spirituality. Reverend Shauna talked about spirituality last week. Here's my version. Do you remember my definition of spirituality? It works for atheists and theists alike, also humanists and Buddhists and most other Unitarian Universalist variants. I define spirituality as a felt connection to something larger than yourself. You need not believe in anything supernatural to experience this kind of spirituality. It is scientific fact. We are interconnected in this web of life. What you do affects others. What others do affects you. What we all do affects our climate. When we feel this interconnection in our bones, when we look in awe at the majesty of the ocean and mountains, when we are moved by an act of human kindness, when we feel connected to anything beyond ourselves, be it human community or the interdependent web of life, that is spirituality. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Thank you. See, I can get the atheist to say amen to this, I promise. There is a power in this kind of spirituality. The power to save the world lies in allowing that feeling of interconnection to arise in us anew. Thus, for me, spirituality and social activism are inextricably linked. Recall the words oft attributed to Chief Noah Seattle. Humankind has not woven the web of life. We are but one thread within it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. All things are bound together. All things connect. And the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. So then I ask, what spiritual practices help you feel the fact of your interconnection and thus reawaken your creative and compassionate powers to heal our planet? Do you share with other social activists your grief, holding it together, working through it together, so that compassion can flow through the grief into action once more? Is the work itself a spiritual practice, offering moments of encouragement and gratification that fill your soul and lift your spirits? Do you walk in nature, cherishing the plants, allowing the mountains and oceans to stir in you feelings of awe, wonder, and reverence? At a workshop I attended last June, the aforementioned Rebecca Parker suggested that when focusing on a future vision of a better world becomes too discouraging, we might instead simply ground ourselves in the love we have for this world, here and now. When we awaken the love we feel for the earth here and now, we naturally respond with heartfelt, compassionate action. The point becomes not success, not even survival, for we will all die eventually. The point is to live our love while we are here. Parker mentioned several other spiritual practices, practicing the Sabbath, practicing tithing, giving away a portion of your income to others. It's a lovely way to experience your interdependence with the web of life. Another spiritual practice, another way to experience the power of our interconnection, is to do social responsibility work in community. We benefit not only from combined action, but also from combined wisdom when the issue gets complicated. Consider, for example, the guidance we can find within our own congregation's Social Responsibility Coalition. In addition to selecting the Share the Plate recipients for us each month, the Social Responsibility Coalition often offers an action of the month, as well as educational articles and discussions. Our issue for January is conflict in the Middle East. As you may know, at our annual national meeting of the Canadian Unitarian Universalists, there was a robust debate on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Everyone there, as does everyone here, I'm sure, wanted peace. Everyone wanted to be respectful of all human rights, Jewish and Palestinian alike. But the group assembled was not at all agreed on the best way to advocate for that vision. Our Social Responsibility Coalition is offering people resources with which to engage after the service on the SRC shelf in the hallway. There and also in the newsletter, you will find information on various methods of advocacy for peace in the Middle East, as well as information on supporting a refugee family from Syria. Our Social Responsibility Coalition has also set up two related events. On February 15th, Raging Granny and Victoria Quaker, Linda Tass, will be speaking after service about her experience on a witness tour in the West Bank of Palestine, run by Friends of Sabil. On March 15th, supporting our theme of curiosity, the practice of collecting a variety of truths, Christine Johnston, Adrian Fine, and the Daniels will offer a service on the topic of human rights in Palestine and Israel. In February, we'll focus on the work of USC Canada, and we'll have the option of three different actions to take, all involving sustainable food growing practices. Stay tuned. In conclusion, I offer an invitation. Whether you are feeling overwhelmed or invigorated, I invite you to join me this Tuesday evening at 6:30 for a workshop on social activism as spiritual practice. Come nourish your soul and join with others who share your yearning for a better world. Let the experience of interconnection unleash the passion and power for transformation that dwells within you. For now, let us sing together. Please rise as you are willing and able, and join in singing We Would Be One.